You'll go down in history. We're talking Rankin Bass and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Hit it. It was the 1980s. Glam rock was all the rage, shoulder pads were in, and Rankin Bass still dominated the holiday TV season. I'm your host, Jerry D, with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, we got it covered. Now joining me are two very special guests. The first is a Totally Rad Christmas all-star and co-host of Tis the Podcast, Anthony Caruso. My second guest, you'll know as the official biographer of the Christmas powerhouse, Rankin Bass, Rick Goldschmidt. Guys, how's it going?
Happy holidays.
It's going great. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, you know, when I asked Rick to do the show, because I've known Rick now for a couple of years, and we met in Dallas at a comic book convention, and it was really cool. But, you know, when I asked him to do the show, the only person that I knew that would love to be on it would be you, because you love Rankin Bass almost as much as I do. And, which I know is probably pales in comparison to how much, you love him, Rick, but, you know, they still hold a special place in our heart.
Oh yeah. Well, it's become a part of my life. So it's not so much, you know, the love of it anymore. It's really become like a day-to-day thing for me, which is weird because I never thought I would be the historian biographer for Rankin Bass, you know, growing up. It was just one of those things I love, but I love a lot of different things. So it's kind of weird to be so associated with these classic Christmas specials and films and everything else.
Yeah, that's awesome though.
And you've had the privilege of actually knowing and becoming friends with a lot of these guys. So, I mean, you knew Arthur Rankin, Maury Laws, and...
Well, Arthur really took me under his wing because we were so similar. He was the art director at ABC TV, and I was doing art, you know, right out of college. That was my thing. I had a degree in illustration, and I was talking to Jack Davis and Paul Coker and Mort Drucker and some other artists wanting to do something like they did. And it just by accident came to the discussion about what are Arthur Rankin and Jules Bass doing now? And Jack said that they were still hiring them occasionally for different things. So I said, I want to call Arthur Rankin up. And he put me in touch with Paul Coker. And I just called Arthur up in Bermuda from my work. And I said, hey, there really should be a book on Rankin Bass. And he was just like, send me two chapters. So I put two chapters together, and the next thing I knew, he sent me his life story and a little micro cassette, which from there, I just started digging everything up. And he didn't save a lot of material, so I really had to scrounge and find this stuff. But when he came to visit me, then we realized that not only were we similar in art, but we were similar in drive for getting things done. And that's where he came into play in the Rankin Bass world. He was the taskmaster. You know, if there was a special that needed to be on the air by December 14th or whatever, he would make sure it happened. You know, he he would have to go to the Japanese studio and tell them, hey, come on, we got to get this done by such and such a date, and so on and so forth. So he really was in charge of the Rankin Bass crew. But what was nice was all the other people involved, Maury Laws and Don Duga and Paul Coker, were the sweetest people you'd ever want to talk to, you know. So it became my mission to make sure that their work was not forgotten. And that's what I'm most proud of, is the fact that, you know, these guys who I started talking to when they were in their late 60s, you know, they're not going to be forgotten. Because what happens is a lot of these companies that own the shows, they don't really want to give credit where credit's due. They want to, like, take it over as a property and say, oh, the Christmas classics, you know. So I kind of bring the focus back on the fact that it's Rankin Bass Productions, which I don't know if you watched the AMC marathons the last couple of years, but they're calling it a Rankin Bass marathon, mostly because of me.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Because I put books out there, and I also talk to those people. So there's a brand, and a lot of these big companies like to forget about that brand and just kind of sweep it under the rug, like they created Rudolph, or they created Mad Monster Party, which is, you know,
it's a good one. I like that one. I do like Mad Monster Party, but I've always been fascinated with, like, the Universal Studios monsters. So that one also kind of has a special place in my heart as well. But that's really interesting. I mean, and then when you think about all the different specials, you know, there's a lot of differences, even though it's almost like one big continuity. Is that because it wasn't originally planned as, you know, one big continuous saga? It was just kind of each company did its own thing, or?
Well, they, you know, they came upon a great writer in Romeo Muller, and they put this staff together, this small crew of people, really, when you look at it, in New York, to come up with the concepts for each of the specials. And I don't think they wanted to make as many specials as they did. I think they wanted to get into feature films more and just go up the ladder. But Rudolph became such a popular annual airing for Christmas that it gave them an identity that they were stuck with, you know. And what amazes me, when you look at my Enchanted World of Rankin Bass book, the 20th anniversary, over 400 pages now, when you look at it, it's amazing how many of them turned out well. Mm-hmm. You know, to do 30 something specials and a dozen movies and all the Saturday morning, you would think a lot of them would be, like, forgotten about and kind of, you know, throwaway pieces, but they're not. You know, most of them have something about them that there's a fan base for. Thundercats and, you know, the Jackson 5 show. I mean, there's just so many different things. Even things like the Bermuda Depths, a small TV movie they made in Bermuda, has a large following. So it's really amazing how much of their stuff actually worked. I would say most of it did.
I was just wondering, was Rudolph their favorite, or what was their personal favorite that they created? Do they have one?
Well, Arthur, he always said he, you know, every one of them was his child. You know, you don't favor one over the other, and so on and so forth. But that was obviously a jewel of the collection. That was something that just everything worked on, music and characters and the story and everything. So I think that was kind of their calling card. When my first book came out, Arthur bought a lot of them from the publisher, because that became his resume. And you know, he was still trying to get things made with Santa Baby and The King and I, and he would take my book as his resume and say, here's what I did. And everyone knows Rudolph and Frosty, mm-hmm. but they don't know really the Rankin Bass name. And mm-hmm. I think that's changing quite a bit with what I've done over the last 30 years. But at the time, people didn't know Rankin Bass Productions was behind all this stuff. And he would have to say, hey, we did Rudolph, you know, and then they would know who he was and, mm-hmm. and what he did. So I don't know. They didn't really favor any one over the other, although I know Arthur was a big fan of Mad Monster Party. And, you know, he loved the Heat Miser and Snow Miser from The Year Without a Santa Claus. In fact,
so good.
I bought resin kits of the characters before they ever produced any toys. And
wow.
I painted a set for him and for Jules because they really wanted them. You know, those characters had a fondness for that. So there were a few that really were fond over. I know Arthur also loved King Kong Escapes because that was their first live action feature film, and he was heavily involved with that. In fact, he casted the lead, Linda, and he was proud of some of those things, even though they weren't really well received critically. You know, it was just a fond memory for him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when he looked over the whole book, he teared up. You know, over especially the 15th anniversary book when we added a bunch of things in, and he was thankful for the career that he had, even though I think he wanted to make a big feature film like a Gone with the Wind or The Wizard of Oz, and they never quite got to that level, you know.
Well, I mean, in a way, they, when you think about it, they did, because Rudolph and Santa Claus Is Coming to Town and Frosty, you know, the big three, those ones are always played every year. And it's, you know, it's a huge, I mean, it's a legacy really is what it is. And so it's, even though it wasn't a big budget, you know, a big budget affair, it really is something that has endured like all these years, 50 years now. And it, you know, you can't think of Christmas without thinking of one of those three.
It's an awesome legacy too. Like, you had now people who are grandparents share it with their kids who are now sharing it with their kids. And it's just amazing. It brings families together around the holidays.
No, I agree. This year is the 50th anniversary of Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. And
that's my personal favorite, by the way. I love that one.
Yeah, I love it too. And my book on that turned out really well. I was real happy with it, mostly due to Wes Garlitz's layout. But, you know, every time I turn that special on, the magic of the storytelling and the characters and the music and everything makes me proud to be involved mm-hmm. with all of this. And, you know, just that one special alone, if they had just done that, I think they would have been a big part of Christmas history, because that's how we learned about Santa Claus, you know, the myths and the ho-ho-hoing and going down the chimney and all of that. That was very clever writing by Romeo Muller, that no one has seen that kind of in-depth analysis of Santa Claus up to that point. 50 years ago.
I was just telling Jerry before you hopped on, it's really like your tip. It's like your superhero origin story, right? This is how he became who he was. And that was awesome. That's why I always loved about it, because I'm a big comic guy. So I was like, wow.
And then to add in the Winter Warlock and the Burgermeister, Meister Burger. I mean, those two characters alone, they're like the Heat Miser and Snow Miser. It's just like everybody knows them. Everybody loves them. They laugh when they see them. It's really something that Romeo was able to create these characters, and then Paul Coker was to design the look of them. And that's your Jack Kirby, Stan Lee type team. That's part of the Rankin Bass galaxy. It are those two guys, and they were a big part of why it's lasted over 50 years now for most of these specials.
So how did that work? It was Romeo would write the script, and then he would send it to Paul, essentially, who would design it.
Yeah, and Paul was really enamored with the scripts, where he thought this was like way better writing than what he knew as children's entertainment, and he could easily come up with characters based on the storytelling, which was, you know, the magic of the team of those two guys. They were really special people that I think Arthur Rankin recognized that right away, and that's why he kept using them over and over and over again. Romeo, for a while, they parted ways. And he went on to do things like Strawberry Shortcake, and he did Little Rascals Christmas special and Puff the Magic Dragon and things like that. So there was a little bit of friction towards the end. I think Arthur didn't like that he was taking so much credit and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And but then when Romeo passed away, right around the time I got a hold of Arthur, and Arthur called me from his memorial. So he went to his memorial, and he really appreciated what Romeo did. And Romeo should have gotten more credit than he did over the years. So I think he, you know, really knew a special kind of writer. Needed for these things, because you can't just put Christmas into the mix and hope for the best. You really have to have the great writing of a guy like Romeo.
Well, you're not wrong about that. On Anthony's show, they review a lot of Christmas movies and Christmas specials. And so you definitely know that you can't just throw Christmas in there.
Oh, no. And we talk about that all the time on the show, that the true classics are few and far in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I can barely watch most of them. You know, I love How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and I love A Charlie Brown Christmas, but that's pretty much it when it comes to animation. There's been so many good ones.
There have been a lot of it. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Pac-Man.
That Miser Bros. Brothers Christmas, like, when I put it on, I could only watch about 30 seconds of it, and I had to get out because I didn't like the way that the Heat Miser and Snow Miser looked. And I didn't like the way the story started out. It was just wasn't for me, you know.
So, yeah, and so that I think is actually one of the better ones, which is saying something.
Which is saying something. Oh yeah, that Rudolph Misfit one was awful.
Oh, that one's terrible. Yeah.
Or what's, so I think what's they another did that on
Returns. That's another bad one.
Oh, Frosty Returns. Yeah. So I have a question. Like, the companies that own the rights to all these. And I'm not saying they should. Have they ever, like, bandied about, like, doing, you know, how nowadays it's the live-action remake is a big thing? Like, have they ever, is there ever talk about doing that? And I'm not saying they should, but, you know, Hollywood. Well,
over the years, I heard from many producers from Hollywood. Don Murphy is one. He did Natural Born Killers. And started the Planet of the Apes project that Tim Burton took over. He wanted to do Rudolph like Babe, with a real reindeer and so on and so forth. And then Mad Monster Party got handed down through a bunch of companies, and they wanted to do it in live action and CGI and all this other stuff. And really, you can't remake these things because they're the animagic is what makes it work, I think.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The stop motion animagic in Japan was a big part of it. And anything you do is not going to look like that unless you do stop motion, which screen novelties in Hollywood could mimic it. I'm not so sure, though, that they could capture the heart of it, because they did that Elf musical special, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And I thought the stop motion looked good. I thought the Santa Claus character that Ed Asner voiced, I thought that looked good, but I couldn't follow the story. Like, it wasn't interesting to me. And I liked the movie, you know? I thought the movie was good, but the stop motion special, I didn't get into it. So I think it was missing the heart and the charm and the warmth that Romeo Muller brought into his writing. So I don't know how you redo something, and especially stuff that's already great. That's where they always fail.
They're already great.
And it's like, you're not going to be great. You know, every time you look at it, something like that, I'm sorry, but you're not great.
It's like that weird analogy, like when you ask somebody for the recipe and it never turns out as good as they did it, and they always come back with, oh, it was the love I put into it, or my secret sauce. That's kind of what it is. Like, Rankin and Bass are the secret sauce for these. They made it work. They were the love behind it.
Well, we always, in Chicago, we had a television personality that I grew up with called Ray Rayner. And he had a show called The Ray Rayner Show. And every week, this, I think it was a woman named Chauncey, would make some kind of craft project, you know, like a flower or, you know, something. And he would try to copy it. And his always turned out so bad. It was comical. And that's exactly what we're talking about with these specials. And the other problem is, look at who's in Hollywood now. Like, nobody there is qualified anymore. That's the weird thing. And I talk about this when I do conventions and panels and things. These guys that Arthur hired were working for 20 or 30 years in the business. You know, Romeo Muller was writing for Jack Benny and writing radio and television. And Paul Coker was, you know, doing art for magazines and Mad Magazine. All these guys, like, their talent level was way up here. And they weren't right out of college. And I think what you find in today's entertainment is they're right out of college. Everybody's been trained the same way, so everything looks the same. And they put people in charge that shouldn't be in charge. So
that's very true. Yep.
Yeah, it is.
Different. And when it hit me hardest was when we were working on the Rudolph 50th anniversary Blu-ray DVD. Yeah. And I got a call from someone at DreamWorks. And she had directed some movie with the name Guardians in it. It wasn't the Guardians of the Galaxy, but it was something like that.
Was it Rise of the Guardians, maybe?
I think so. And I'm talking to her and some other woman, and I'm telling them, I've been doing this now for like 20 years or whatever. I know what the fans want. They want to see, like, behind the scenes. In other words, my book, but like a documentary.
Yeah, you know? For real, that's like, what I wanted.
I love your book. I love your book. And I was like, well, here's what they want. And she's like, I think they want pop-up stories and things for kids to do. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what? Who am I talking to here? But like, it's so obvious that if you're going to put extra content on a Blu-ray, you focus on the show and give the history behind it with the people that made it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't understand that concept, and right there I knew the age difference and the quality of the people, and it's just not there, you know? It's sad, but it's really a different world that we live in.
Well, you're not wrong. I mean, I remember I was so excited when I saw the 50th anniversary Blu-ray. And so, of course, I bought it. And yeah, I was crazy disappointed just with the lack. I mean, it's the 50th anniversary. Why wouldn't you have, you know, the behind
like the big story? Documentary?
Yeah. I mean, I want to know about Maury Laws. I mean, give me a whole thing just on Romeo Muller. Give me a whole thing on, you know, Tony Peters. But I mean, all these... You know, all these that I just I wanted to hear about, and I just unfortunately we didn't get it. Yeah,
it's funny, Jerry, because I was going to pick up that 50th anniversary too. Mm-hmm. And they had a bunch of the different anniversaries a few years ago. It wasn't just Rudolph; it was whatever anniversary the Grinch was, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right,
I was
going
to pick them all up, but when I looked on Amazon reviews, bunch of people, most people were complaining about the lack of special features, the lack of behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I'm not going to waste my money. I own these as they are. If I was going to spend more, I want the detailed history. I want the documentary. Give me a full-length doc on how this was made. Mm-hmm. And its legacy. Yeah.
Well, the 2018 Universal releases are the worst yet, because that one, they got a hold of me early, like a year before they came out, and they were like, we want to do it right. Everybody hated the old stuff. We want to do it right. We're going to do documentaries. We're going to do this, that. We're going to fly you out. We're going to have you do commentary and call up everyone that's still living. So I called up everyone, and most of them declined because they're in their early 90s if they're still living. And they're like, no, I don't want to do it. So I came back and I said, well, we could still do it this way. You know, we have old interviews with them. I have a lot of different archival things. I even have the ending of Rudolph in color. My friend has it, the 64 version with the original credits in color. And they were like, politics got into it, where they involved people that shouldn't be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was out. I was out. So I said, you know what? I am going to tell people not to buy these things. And I will put up a review on Amazon and so forth. And I don't know why you'd want to do that, you know, but they did. And they got some people involved that don't even like Rankin Bass in the documentaries. I haven't watched them, because I don't want to get mad. And if they're using my information out of my books, I'm really going to get mad, you know. But
right.
That instead of doing things right and, you know, really exploring the enchanted world of Rankin Bass, they chose to go the opposite way, which, you know, it's sad.
So how did they decide to do Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer as their first special?
Well, Arthur's neighbor was Johnny Marks, who wrote the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And he would see him occasionally at parties. Arthur's originally Rankin Bass Productions was in Arthur's home, and it was a brownstone in New York. So I think he lived really close to Johnny Marks, and they would attend parties together. So that was where the idea came from. It was all Arthur's idea. And then eventually they got involved with a couple different people from NBC. And one of them, Willard Sailoff, came from Montgomery Ward's, who was at General Electric. And he knew Rudolph would be a hit on television and paved the way for it to get onto TV. And Larry Romer, who was given director's credit, who didn't direct Rudolph at all, he was from NBC. So they kind of got their way into the network through a couple of guys that knew Rudolph was going to be a success. But they didn't know it was going to be as big as it became. Mm-hmm. And thank God it was. And, but it's funny that there was no merchandise produced until after my book came out. 1 year later, the Stuffins and CVS Pharmacy release. But before that, there was nothing other than that record album that they gave away in a GE promotion in 65. So it's kind of funny how, you know, such a big popular show wasn't marketed until now. And now look at there's stuff everywhere, you know, hardware stores and Walmart. It doesn't matter where you go and you'll see something from Rudolph.
Yeah, I have a bunch of the Rudolph action figures that they sell nowadays. Right. So, yeah, I love them. I can't believe that it's only been... they weren't selling the stuff from the beginning. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, especially because it was shown every single year since it's... Mm-hmm. I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, if you have a show that, you know, you believe in, it did super well, you know, in the Nielsen's, why wouldn't you promote it? I mean, I don't get it.
it's funny that it took my book to put the idea into the guy who ran the company Stuffins to actually merchandise dolls. And I don't know if you remember that craze, but back then it was before eBay, and there was a newspaper that collectors would get, the Toy Shop newspaper. And CVS Pharmacies was only on the East Coast. And there was one by me in Munster, Indiana, which wasn't too far from where I live. But what was happening was people were buying them up and then shipping them, you know, west. And people could only order them through that newspaper or different magazines and things. eBay wasn't born yet. So it was kind of interesting how it became so popular that 1 year in 1998. And then the following year, they produced all kinds of stuff. And they were stuck with a lot of it because they went way overboard. They had trees and plates and you name it, they had it, you know, slippers and all kinds of stuff.
So we talked about Paul Coker, and I know he designed a lot of the Rankin Bass stuff, but he didn't design the Rudolph itself, did he? It wasn't,
Tony Peters. And Tony was a really great guy. He designed everything for Rankin Bass from the mid-50s to 64. And he left to start his own company, Instant Miracles, because he didn't feel appreciated. In fact, with Rudolph, he was brought back as a freelancer. But he was this young kid that worked at Arthur's home, basically, when it was Rankin Bass Productions. And a lot of what he did was commercials. It was they did a lot of television commercials, both animated and just regular live commercials. And he would design the type and do different things. And then when they did Tales of the Wizard of Oz and The New Adventures of Pinocchio, he not only designed the lettering and the characters, but he also oversaw the production at Crawley Studios in Canada for Arthur and Jules. So he got involved more, but I guess he didn't feel like he was a big player in the team, and he decided to just branch out on his own. But we had some great conversations, and he loved New York, and just a great guy, all around great guy. And for me, the early designs are better than the later because they were more simplistic. And I felt like his style was more like UPA, and that was good for the puppets in Rudolph because they're so simple. And in fact, if you look at the elves, I think the reason that they have that bulbous nose is originally he designed that for a light bulb. And in earlier commercials, because he sent me a picture of my book with the carolers, they all have that same nose, you know? So I think that's why he designed them that way. Because earlier on he was doing the commercial work. So I just love that simple style. You know, it's very stylistic and very easy to animate too.
Mm-hmm. And it's effective too. I mean, you want to talk about legacy. I mean, if you look at Elf, the North Pole is Rudolph's North Pole, just about, from the Elf designs to the background and everything.
That's true. Yeah. Buddy dresses like the Elf foreman, you know, in the green and all that.
I was involved in a show for 2020 a couple of years ago on ABC, and they interviewed him about the movie, and he said he got the designs from Rudolph. So he came right out and said, you know, that was his inspiration. So you could tell it, although the stop motion that they used didn't quite match up to the Rankin Bass quality. It looks more like the stuff that you see in commercials where they're parroting Rankin Bass.
So I have a story question, Jerry, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So one of the things I find really impressive about Rankin Bass, whether it's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or Frosty the Snowman or Santa Claus is Coming to Town, is they took these well-known songs and expanded the world and made... introduce all these characters that are just as iconic to people nowadays as the song themselves are, whether that's the Misfit Toys or Burgermeister Meisterburger or Professor Hinckley in Frosty. And I guess, do you have any insight on as to how they came up with all these like supporting characters? How, like, what was their process for developing these children's songs into full-fledged specials and developing the world with all these new iconic characters?
Well, a lot of the credit has to go to Romeo Muller, because he kind of had carte blanche on developing his own story from the song, you know. And you're right, the song was a way of going to a network and saying, we're going to do Frosty the Snowman, or we're going to do the Little Drummer Boy. But when Arthur went to NBC and said, we're going to do the Little Drummer Boy, they said, we want to have the script by Monday. And this was on Friday. So he called up Romeo Muller, and Romeo Muller wrote this thing over the phone and gave it to a secretary to take down. You know, it was like that. He really had to be a creative guy to expand these stories in such a way that what we know the Little Drummer Boy from, what we know Santa Claus from, what we know Rudolph and Frosty from, are the Rankin Bass specials. Not the song, not the comic books that came out in the 50s. Not the golden books that were out in the 50s and 60s, or even the commercials with Santa Claus selling cigarettes and Coca-Cola. You know, it's all Rankin Bass that we know these characters. And it really was Romeo Muller was the guy. Now, I think what would happen is he would bring a script in and give it to Arthur, and Arthur would go through it and involve some other people, maybe Jules at times, maybe, you know, the network guys, and they would say, get rid of this seal, because I think there was a talking seal in the original draft in my Rudolph book. Or get rid of this character, or bring in this character. Yeah, so I think there was some tweaking towards the end, but the genesis of the story came from Romeo, and then they just edited it from there, which is pretty amazing for one guy.
Amazing, yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. And to the point you were making earlier, too, like, these are the versions we think of. Like, now mm-hmm. when I hear these songs on the radio around the holidays, it's the Rankin Bass characters I'm picturing in my head when, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is playing on the radio, for example.
Mm-hmm. Or when you hear Holly Jolly Christmas, you know, and immediately think of Burl Ives as Sam the Snowman and just the elves dancing. And I mean, it's everything about it is just, you focus on those images and they stay with you, which is a magical thing, I think. Especially for a Christmas special.
Well, the other thing is, and I get asked this all the time in when I do my panels and things, the trick of it all is not to come up with a story and the characters. The trick is to put the heart and the warmth into them that makes you want to watch these things 150 times, mm-hmm. you know. There's this, and they called their animation Animagic, and it did have a magic to it. To write in such a way that you love these characters, that you want to see them succeed, that you feel warm and cozy at Christmas time mm-hmm. watching them, that it puts you in a better mood than you were in, you know, like, it's such a happy thing, and you can't even describe that part of it. You can't copy it. And I think that's where, when you see these newer attempts at Christmas specials, they're completely missing that part of it. You know, the heart and warmth is, you only get that in certain things. You know, you get it in movies like It's a Wonderful Life and White Christmas. And, you know, Going My Way and Bells of St. Mary's, that stuff all had heart and warmth to it. And Rankin Bass is kind of the same thing, but everything else is kind of missing that. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't copy it, you know. It's just something that happened through Romeo's writing and the animation that was... that furthered that heart and warmth.
I mean, the perfect example is that, what was it, the 1998 or 2000 theatrical Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that came out, the traditionally animated one, like, it just lacked that warmth. Like, they decided to just turn it into kind of like a action fantasy movie, whereas they didn't get to the core of who Rudolph was, like Rankin Bass was, like the underdog misfit status of Rudolph that everyone mm-hmm. can relate to, and it just left the movie feeling so hollow, like
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Well, last year they put out Here Comes Peter Cottontail on Blu-ray, and it was cut. It was the syndicated version, missing all kinds of scenes and parts and everything. Mm-hmm. So I watched a little bit of that Peter Cottontail CGI thing that they did 10 or 15 years ago. Roger Moore was in it. It was awful. You know, like it had none of the Rankin Bass charm and quality and warmth and nothing. So, I mean, they keep making the same mistakes over and over, trying to remake or do sequels or whatever, but you're not going to be able to do it with the Rankin Bass shows, you know?
Right.
I think what's really amazing is that, I mean, nowadays we can do anything with computers, but I mean, they had to be really imaginative to do it all practically, you know? So to make water look like actual water, you know, like when you're thinking about Shiny New Year and Big Ben coming up, things like that, they had to be really creative. And I think people nowadays are just spoiled because you want water. Oh, you just, you know, type in the code, and not to diminish anything that they do, because I do have a friend that does that, and I know it's difficult, but at the same time, it's not quite, I mean, you don't have to be quite as inventive. And I think that it's that creativity, you know, it sparks like some sort of energy that sometimes is missing. And that's why some of those things seem very flat, you know, when you compare it with like what Mochinaga and those guys did to get those effects. I mean, it is quite brilliant when you think about it.
Yeah, they use cellophane for the water waves. Ed Mochinaga was hired because Arthur knew he was the father of stop motion animation in Japan. And eventually he retired towards the end of the 60s, and Hiroshi Tabata, who was working directly under him, took over, and he always felt inferior to Tad. Everyone felt Tad was the master and Rudolph was as good as it gets. And sometimes people will say, Rudolph looks kind of crude and herky and jerky and all this. And I'm thinking, that's what I like about it. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to CGI perfect stuff. Now with Pixar, which I could talk about forever, I was friends with the small group of people that were known as Pixar when they started, because Andrew Stanton did a quote for the back of my book and John Lasseter told them to call me. So every year they sent me a book with all the artists drew in it, and each movie got better and better and better. And the reason that they did such great work was that writing, you know, they knew that in order for things to sustain and have life to them, they had to be well written. And they would go through writing story meetings and in front of the animators and then redo it and all of that. And I know this because Joe Ranth was a friend of mine who helped me a little bit with the Rudolph book. And Stanton did the afterword in the book, and he got the Academy Award for Finding Nemo, and I think WALL-E. And they got better and better and better and better. And then Disney decided to buy the company, and it was a complete creative sellout. Complete. And the next movie they put out, Cars 2, I took my son to, and I couldn't tell you one thing about the movie that I could remember. And then everything just went down the toilet, and it was just a complete creative sellout. And that's a shame, because they were on target to be the, you know, well, they were the Rankin Bass of this world, this modern world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Up to the movie Up. That's what I always say. And, some people say they like, what was the one with the Mexican?
Coco.
Coco.
Some people say they like Coco and they like this and that. I haven't seen much of any of that. But, you know, they sacrificed that team of great people for the dollar when they did that. I think Cars 2, what the idea was to sell a bunch of cars and forget about the movie. Just sell cars. And that's, you know, it goes back to what I said earlier about Rankin Bass. They only hired good quality people that had years and years of experience. And that's changed. you know, it's more about the money today. It's more about box office and the weekend receipts and this and that. And mm-hmm. I don't think Arthur and Jules and anybody in their staff were trying to become millionaires, you know. Mm-hmm. I think they were trying to make good quality stuff that would last, and it did.
Sure did, yeah. I mean, like I said, when people think of Christmas, they think of Rudolph, you know, for sure.
Right.
And of course, and Santa Claus is coming, and Frosty and all that. But I mean, that's it's so ingrained now in our culture that, you know, I mean, you can't, at least here in America, maybe not so much in some other places, but for sure in America, it's like, that's what you think of. And it, at least for me, it doesn't feel like Christmas if I miss it that year. I mean, luckily I own them, so I never do. But in the past, whenever I missed it, it just, something was missing. You know, it just, it wasn't quite Christmas time yet.
And you could walk into the home of 99% of Americans and they will have some kind of Rankin Bass ornament or like statue or something around Christmas time on their tree without fail. Like whether it's Rudolph or Frosty or Kris Kringle, whoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I work at a Christmas store now and same thing, we have a couple of Rudolph things like that, but I mean, it's in a different department, so I haven't really looked at it too much, but you know, it's one of those where I mean, you can find Rudolph stuff just all over because it is so iconic. And I think that's cool. I really do.
Yeah. I you know, as much as I've been involved, now I have 6 books out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty tired of seeing Rudolph material year after year after year after year. And what I think is there's some unexplored things, like let's talk about Nestor the long-eared donkey, which people love that. You know, it's like Rankin Bass's version of Bambi, you know?
Yeah, yes, it really is.
So people are always saying, hey, I want to get a Nestor figure or a Nestor this. When are they ever going to do that? And then, you know, they did the little drummer boy for a few years, and now that stuff costs a fortune because nobody ever merchandised it since. So I think they need to do more little drummer boy. And, you know, they're always doing the Heat Miser and Snow Miser at Hallmark. Mm-hmm.
I love the Miser brothers. Those are my dad's favorites. So my dad, who's not even like huge on Christmas, like he loves the Miser brothers. He loves that song so much. Like he'll turn it on just to hear the song whenever it's on TV.
And that's a classic Maury Laws right there. I mean, it's just, it's a, you know, yeah, Johnny Marks did a lot of the songs for Rudolph, but I mean, you kind of miss, when you focus on that, you miss Maury Laws and a lot of the great stuff that he did later on. And I mean, that's definitely a shame because I really enjoy what he did. That music, not only the score, but the songs also really helped a lot of those later specials. And you kind of miss out on some of that when you focus just on the Johnny Marks and the popular ones.
Well, early on, Jules Bass wrote the songs by himself. And then he got involved with Burrell, Thomas, and Pollock, who wrote the music for Willie McBean and His Magic Machine and Return to Oz. And Jules brought Maury in as the musical conductor on Rudolph. And when you hear that overture at the beginning of Rudolph, that gives me chills. Mm-hmm. That I think that's the best. The best thing he ever orchestrated is how that, you know, he puts all the songs together in the arrangement he does. And it's always so bouncy and fun and happy. You know, he always got happiness into the music. But when Jules and Maury came together as songwriters, that was the key to Rankin Bass, because there's no better soundtrack than the one in Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And the one they did right after it, Here Comes Peter Cottontail.
Oh, I like that one, yeah.
Songs in those are better than songs in Broadway musicals, you know, which he dabbled in, too. So that songwriting team was magic, and it lasted for a long time, too, well into the 80s. And that says a lot because, you know, it came together kind of organically, you know, without any idea. We're going to do 30 specials and we're going to corner the market on Christmas. And which all they did. That. It wasn't like that. It was just they had some good people working on these things, and they kept them together for a long time. Arthur was a smart guy too. When he saw something, I think he could tell if it was going to work or if it wasn't going to work. He had a good ear and a good eye for that, for most of it. So it needed to have good leadership too.
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, I forgot what I was going to say.
I have a question for you.
Okay, go for it.
just out of curiosity, which one is your favorite Rankin Bass? And I know it's probably hard for you to pick since you're so like ingrained with them, but like if you had to pick one, which is your favorite one they've done?
Well, I think it's in the order of my books that have come out. I had to do a Rudolph book right away because that's the crown jewel of the Rankin Bass catalog. But I also love Mad Monster Party a lot too, which, you know, is not a Christmas thing, but like Jerry said, I love the Universal Monsters. And I don't think there's any animated monster film better than that because they have them all in there, you know, including Boris Karloff. So, yeah. Most of the time, if you were going to have a Boris Karloff in an animated show, you would get somebody to impersonate his voice. That was done constantly for years in every show. On every cartoon series had a Boris Karloff character, and they had somebody impersonate him. But to bring him in and make a character that looked like him and let him do his own voice, that doesn't get any better than that. But, you know, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Like you said, that's your favorite. That's right up there with my favorite too. And then Frosty, you know, was one of my earliest childhood memories too. I probably saw the first airing of it in 69. And, you know, the character of Frosty, he was nobody until that. You know, Jackie Brennan brought that character to life, and Paul Coker's art style brought that character to life. And that's who you think of when you think of Frosty, are those characters. And that's the one great achievement of Rankin Bass Productions, is the personality of the characters. They could bring personality to every character. They would hire just the right guy or girl to do the voices, and they would design them in such a way that you knew it was a Rankin Bass show, and that would be the character that you would remember forever.
Frosty is like, you just want to give the guy a hug. He's so childish and innocent, and I love his design. Just for the way they voice him to the look of him, like, he's awesome. He's amazing.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Professor Hinkle is one of the squirreliest, hateable characters that you can get, but they found the perfect actor to do him, Billy DeWolf, with the busy and you know, how nasty he is towards Frosty. Mm-hmm. It was So you could talk about every special has that perfect villain in it, and they're comical and they're nasty, but you know, they're memorable too. So it's a weird combination of things, but that's what sometimes I like the villains more than the like in Rudolph. I love the Bumble.
I love the Bumble.
My brother, when we were real young, he was afraid of the Bumble because the way they portrayed him, you know, at the beginning, just peeking over the mountain and having the big footprint, and you see the shadow, and Burl Ives is shivering with the umbrella. They portrayed him in such a way that he was this scary, you know, kind of like the witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end, he's a tree decorator with no teeth. So,
well, to your point about how great the villains are, I love, if you look at Santa Claus is Going to Town, I love the Burgermeister's song more than Tanta Kringle's song. How it's the inverse of it, about destroying all these toys. I love it. It's so fun. I hum that one all the time.
Well, that was the only character that didn't get reformed. One of the early interviews that Arthur and I did right after my book came out, they asked him, hey, what's with the Burgermeister? And Arthur was like, well, we put a tincture of poison in the mix. And you know, and his picture fell off the wall. But what I love about the Burgermeister is he represents all politicians, where they yes. say one thing and they do another. And, yep. and he broke his own law with the yo-yo. And that was perfect writing, because that represents most of the politicians that we see today. And I shared a thing on Facebook and social media with the Burgermeister, because he's perfect for that. And Paul Frees, even though he did millions of characters, he's mostly known for that character and a few others, you know, because it's such a great job.
Paul Frees is one of the, like, as soon as I hear his voice, even if it's not Rankin Bass, but as soon as I hear his voice, the first thing I think of, yes, is Burgermeister. But then also, you know, he played Santa a couple of times. And so sometimes, you know, right after right. Burgermeister, then I immediately jumped to Santa. And I mean, he just did so many voices for Rankin Bass that it, to me, you can't talk Rankin Bass without talking Paul Frees. And so I'm glad you brought him up, because that was...
intro to Santa Claus is Coming to Town too. He had a narration voice that he would use. So he narrates the beginning of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And I think Here Comes Peter Cottontail as well, when they're showing all that footage from Christmases around the world and stuff. And that's kind of a cool thing too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, he also did Grinsley, the second banana.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. There was a delay.
He was all over the place.
I do have to ask you about the Burgermeister. And I've told this to Jerry. I've asked Jerry this multiple times, and he was unsure. So I want to ask you, because you mentioned he's like the perfect embodiment of every politician that's out there. Did they base his design at all on Nixon? Because he has a very Nixon-y face. Did they like take any inspiration from that?
I think they kind of based him a little bit off of Paul Frees, because he was kind of that heavy set guy that looked very similar to Burgermeister. And sometimes Paul Coker would get the actors who are going to do the voices, he would get their photographs. So I think he kind of used that to design the character more so than Nixon. Although, who knows? Paul Coker could have done it that way.
before we... Before we start wrapping it up, I did want to talk about the ending, the original ending to Rudolph. And so in the original special, when it first aired, it had this beautiful ending credit sequence, but I know there was a lot of kids kind of complaining because Santa doesn't actually go back to pick up the misfit toys.
Right. The original ending I like better because the lettering on the packages matches the Tony Peters lettering at the beginning of the special. And it's a better idea to see the credits on the packages. But the reason that they reshot it and added in scenes and took scenes out, it wasn't so much, you know, some people had said, and I might have mentioned this in my book, but over the years I found out it wasn't so much a write-in campaign. I think Jules Bass had told me that he heard that, or he seems to remember that, but I think it was more that Willard Sailoff, the General Electric person that was in charge of the production, wanted the changes himself. He wanted a new song, so they changed the song to Fame and Fortune. And then the credits were changed to show the Misfit Toys and give them a little bit more airtime. But I don't think it was a big complaining kind of thing because it was, you know, from one showing, I don't think you're going to get that kind of a response so much from kids. And it was weird. It aired at 4:30, I think 4:30 Central Time, or it could have been 5:30. So early in the evening, I kind of think they missed their larger audience, even though it had a big ratings when it was aired so early in the evening. I don't know who was watching it at that time. But, yeah, I like the original credits better than the ones that they show now, but they're both good.
I don't know if I've ever seen the original credits, actually.
It's good. It's really neat. Yeah, the lettering and everything, it's just, it's really cool. And it like Rick said, it fits perfectly with the beginning, which is nice. It's a nice bookend that you kind of miss out on. Although I do like the idea of, you know, Santa actually picking up the misfit toys.
Well, you know, I think the umbrella idea was kind of, I don't know if the Flintstones aired their Christmas episode first, because if you watch that episode, Fred's dropping the toys off in parachutes out of the sleigh. So I don't know which one came first, but it's a similar concept with the umbrellas. And then a lot of people say, well, why did they throw the bird who can only swim off without an umbrella? Was that a dark joke or something? I don't know. It might have been through the animators. You know, the animators might have said, hey, this will be kind of funny if we do it with him getting thrown off, even though he doesn't have an umbrella. But it could be like the Wizard of Oz, too, because Romeo wrote Return to Oz, and, you know, all the characters had those things that they were looking for in the first place, so maybe he really could fly.
That's awesome.
So I have to ask, what would you say is your happiest memory of this, of Rankin Bass in general, and Rudolph specifically?
I don't know. They all kind of blend together now. You know, doing this so long. I'll tell you, like, doing what I do, Christmas time is always magical for me. And I make it such, too, because I really make a big deal out of the holidays, Halloween included. And nothing is better than, you know, conversing with the fans through social media and email and appearances and things like that, because it keeps me going, because, you know, it means something to everyone, you know, or at least a lot of people. And that's what kind of keeps me going. That's what drives me. And then just the fact, like you said, to be friends with all of these people is another level. Because when I see the credits at the end of these shows, I think, oh yeah, there's Maury and there's Don Duca and there's Paul Coker. And then I think back to like when, you know, you got to meet Paul Coker in Dallas.
That was cool. Yeah.
We had a wonderful time there, and NPR did an interview with us, and just being with Paul and getting along with them so well. And it's kind of like, and I say this a lot, it's like a calling for me. I didn't want, I never set out to do books and to be talking about Rankin Bass as much as I do. But I'm glad that I did it. And it's just like, it's weird. It's like a calling, and it's great to be able to shine the light on the people that put these things together. And, you know, this year's the 50th anniversary of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. 50 years, you know, 56 years for Rudolph. It's like, wow, these things are never going to end, I don't think. Even if they get rid of the network television, and, you know, there's always going to be streaming and DVDs and Blu-rays and all this stuff. So it just lives on. It's outlived the creators now, most of them. And I just want to make sure that it's handled right, you know, as much as you can. As I don't like seeing people making money off the things they didn't create. And I see that a lot, especially with Rudolph and some of these others. But just the whole thing for me is the magic of the season. And I love them all, you know, even the more forgotten about Jack Frost and Rudolph's Shiny New Year is a great one for New Year's. And they didn't show it on ABC last year, but they did for the several years before that. So I don't know. I hope they keep, it seems like they're showing them more now. Freeform got Rudolph, Frosty, and Santa Claus is Coming to Town last year. So they're not only showing them on CBS and ABC, but they're showing them on Freeform now too. And then AMC is having that marathon every year, and I think that's getting bigger and bigger for them. So who knows?
Yeah, there's a ton of forgotten specials, which, again, is a shame. I remember them throughout my childhood always being there. What's the Night Before Christmas? You know, Twas the Night Before Christmas? That one's
I love that one.
I mean, I love that one. The songs in that one are some of my favorite out of the entire Rankin Bass catalog. The Little Drummer Boy and Book One and Book Two are just really good.
Cricket on the Hearth.
Nestor. Cricket on the Hearth. That one you don't really see much anymore. I really love Christmas in July. Rudolph and Frosty. Right. July is a great one.
So what was the thought process about behind the scenes setting that their first big Christmas crossover in July instead of at Christmas? Was there like a reasoning behind that? What was the thought behind that?
Well, that was one of the sort of failures, because they thought it was going to be combining Frosty and Rudolph and doing it as a feature film that it was going to be a huge hit. But they released it in the summer, and it bombed, you know. It wasn't the hit that they wanted it to be. So then they ended up editing it to make it a 90-minute television special. So it did better on TV than it did in the theater. I know in 79, I wasn't even aware of the movie being released. And that was like the prime time for me growing up that I would have went to the movies to see something like that. But I probably didn't even know it was out because it got such little attention. But it failed at the show. Arthur always said because it came out in the summer, you know, had they released it in at Christmas time, it probably would have done better.
I definitely think it would have, honestly.
Yeah, me too.
I like it. I really enjoy it. It's fun. Winterbolt is like the villain of villains, you know, Rankin Bass universe to me.
I mean, me and Jerry had fun a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of talking about, like, you know, how Rankin Bass had their own little Marvel Universe before the Marvel Universe is a thing, and Winterbolt was a big right. Thanos for them all to beat.
Exactly. And you mentioned 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. That's another one that, because of the music and the characters, the writing and the Coker look and everything, it's just magic to watch that. Mm-hmm. I'm really surprised that CBS took that off. I don't know what happened, if the ratings dropped 1 year and they said, okay, pull it, or they just pulled it and then forgot about it, because that blows away Frosty Returns, and that's what they put on in its place. Because they used to do Frosty and 'Twas the Night Before Christmas together. So it's like, oh my God, this That's like a 4-star versus a half a star.
yeah. Frosty Returns is bad. It's very bad.
Really, you know?
It's. But
Bill Melendez was involved with that, wasn't he? And it's like, what in the hell?
Yeah, which is funny because you would think on paper John Goodman would probably make a really good Frosty.
Yeah,
it's just the look of it right off the bat is like, what is this?
Yeah, it's look, very 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 low budget Rankin Bass. Like ripoff of a ripoff. But yeah, I mean, you know, based on everything you've said, I mean, I would like to see also more merchandise for some of the more obscure ones. I would buy a lot of that stuff up in a second. And I would like to see more airplay for some of these more obscure ones as well. You know, The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus is really cool.
Oh, yeah.
That one's really trippy.
It's a weird one, but
it is weird, yeah. But
Arthur didn't like it.
Really?
Because I had him sign something for a friend of mine when he came, and he kind of slammed it down and said he didn't like it. But it was a completely different take. And their style and their characters. And I think it has a strong following. Mm-hmm. And people do remember it. And, you know, there's good and bad things about it, but it turned out pretty well. You know, I think it was true to the book. It's a completely different style to it. And they were moving that way with The Hobbit and Return of the King and The Flight of Dragons and getting into more magical kind of projects at that point.
Yeah, more of the fantasy. I mean, because I love Thundercats and Silverhawks. Those were really fun. The Hobbit, before I even read the book, I knew the Rankin Bass version of it. And so reading the book was a breeze because I had already kind of experienced it. And so when I remember reading the book for the first time in, I think, sixth grade, maybe seventh, but I remember I would picture, you know, the Rankin Bass versions of it as I was reading it. And to this day, every time I read it, I still think of that Bilbo and I still think of that Gollum, even though, you know, Lord of the Rings came out and we have all those, you know, the live action versions and all that. But to me, like that's the Hobbit, you know, and those are my characters. So I know what you mean. And I think it would be really cool. I think I even have a record version of it somewhere with one of those books. Yeah, it's really cool.
I got to go to Sundance because of the Rankin Bass Hobbit and Return of the King, because there was a documentary made called Ringers that mostly focused on the films, but they worked in a little bit about the history of it and the Rankin Bass. So I helped them with the Rankin Bass part, and I got to go to Sundance and and what that whole phenomenon was about. So that was kind of fun. There's been a lot of things that have happened like that over the years. This year, though, I should mention that my my business partner passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that.
In April, right when this pandemic was picking up. He had a heart attack and passed away in a ambulance. And he was such a big part of what I do. He was like my support team, Wes Garlitz, and even co-author on the Frosty and the Santa Claus is Coming to Town book and the Arthur Rankin scrapbook. And he really put together the books in such a way that it's like a visual extravaganza, you know. And what's ironic is we just got the Frosty book done. I picked it up in early January because the printer got behind and they didn't make Christmas. And I really pushed, even though, you know, I didn't cause Wes's heart attack, but I pushed to get the books done, and I didn't know why I was doing it. You know, so I'm glad we got the six books in his lifetime. And that's kind of what he will be remembered for, you know, is the work on these books. And, you know, that's how I'll think of Wes, too, when I think of Rankin Bass and the Christmas season, because he was such a big part of it for my, you know, the last 12 years of my life. It'll be weird going through the holiday season without them this year, but anyway, he's a big part of what I've done up to this point, and he loved it just as much as anyone, and got to work a little bit with Arthur Rankin, and we did the shag stores together, and that was a big thing. And so
normally, and you know, I hope he, you know, may he rest in peace. But on a brighter note, normally at this point in the show, I do a segment that I like to call Gag Me with the Spoon, where we do our best impressions of our least favorite parts. But in the spirit of, you know, just the warm fuzzies that Rankin Bass gives you, I thought it'd be fun if we just do some of our favorite quotes from some of the specials. Do you have like a favorite quote from Rudolph or anything that, or any of the specials that just really talks to you, or is just one of your favorites?
Well, probably when the elves are all saying Hermie doesn't like to make toys, because a lot of people think he's saying Herbie, and it does sound like that in that scene. Sounds like the voice actors mispronounced it a little bit in that part where there's, it does sound like he's saying Herbie. But I like how they have the elves all saying, Hermie doesn't like to make toys. Hermie doesn't like to make toys. That's like real clever, a real clever performance. And they do that a lot in all of their shows, you know? Like when Chris is on the doorstep, when the elves get him and Santa Claus is coming to town, and they're saying a baby, whatever, Dingle and Kringle and all the names. That's a good funny part, too.
What about you, Anthony? Do you have a favorite quote here or there?
From Rudolph?
From whichever.
I think it's really, I don't want to use the word because it's in the quote. I think it's really cute when Clarice kisses him on the cheek and says, "I think you're cute." And Rudolph is like, "I'm cute. I'm cute. She thinks I'm cute." And he starts prancing around and he flies her the first time farther than any of the other reindeer.
That is a good one. That is a very good one. Yeah. Of course you can relate to that, you know?
It's, oh yeah, totally. One of those,
when the girl kind of likes you, it's just like, yeah.
You're over the moon. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the ones that I actually like Yukon Cornelius, because one of the things before I realized that he was looking for a peppermint mine, I thought he was looking for silver and gold, you know, from the edits. And, when I eventually discovered that it was actually about peppermint, and he says, "Peppermint, what I've been searching for all of my life. I've struck it rich. I've got me a peppermint mine. Woohoo!"
I love that weird little tongue thing he does when he licks
the peppermint. Yeah, because he's always licking the pickaxe, and I remember not understanding it. And
that scene hasn't been on the network since the first airing.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yes. When they restored it somewhat years ago, they never put that in, which is only like 30 seconds long. I don't know why they didn't do it, but it's still, I don't know if on ABC Family, if they show it on there or Freeform, because I don't have that channel. So I don't know what edit they're showing on there, but on CBS, they still haven't shown that peppermint. But the cute scene, I did a lot of radio interviews with Billy Mae Richards before she passed, and she would always do the cute during the interview.
That's awesome.
She could do the voice pretty well still in at the end of her life. And originally, Billy Mae was a little bitter about the fact that she only made like $6,000 or whatever from her work and didn't make anything after that.
Wow.
So when I first tried to get a hold of her, I think it was through her agent, and her agent was like, she doesn't want to talk about Rudolph, you know. And eventually I got through to her. I think it was because we were on a radio show together. They brought us together in Canada. And after that, you know, I was calling her up and talking for a long time, and I sent her toys and different things, and she just changed. She knew that's what she was going to be remembered for, and she just loved it. You know, it was, she couldn't be happier that was what her legacy is. So it wasn't, you know, the fact that she made so little off of it. It was just, that's what she's going to be remembered for. So glad that I was able to help her a little bit as far as do those interviews and things.
That's so cool. I mean, I know you were also friends with, and sorry, I know we're running long here, so I'll try to wrap it up, but I know you're friends with Bradley, you know, it's just knowing these guys, I mean, that's, to me, it's amazing just to be able to call them up and say, "Hey, how you doing? Let's, you know, let's do this show here or something." I mean, wow, that's really cool.
It's awesome. I mean, I think me and you both agree, Jerry, that's like dream job, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
See, these people had such a quality to them, too. Like, you know, they worked on a lot of different things, and they were talented and really good at what they did. And I appreciated that more than some people did. In fact, what Maury Laws he was kind of surprised and shocked and protective of different things. Like when I first started talking to him, I was like, I want to get a copy of Mad Monster Party soundtrack. And he'd be like, what do you want that for? You know, like I'm not going to send that to you. And I'm like, no, I really love it. I'm a musician and this and that. And eventually he sent it to me. I was the first person to get it because it wasn't released when the movie came out. RCA shelved it. So he had an acetate copy of it, and that was it.
Oh, gosh. So
he was like, what do you want this stuff for? You know, like, he was very protective. And then he realized that I'm just trying to expose it to the fans and give you credit and all of that. So then we became really good friends and would meet for dinner downtown in Chicago when he would visit his son and things. So it's amazing that I was able to develop friendships with all these great people because, like I said, they were in their late 60s when I started doing this. So, you know, and now a lot of them are gone. And it's shocking to me that I can't call up Maury Laws or Arthur Rankin or whatever. But at least I can write about them and talk about and podcast and on the radio at Christmas time and all this other good stuff. So,
yeah, that's really cool. You know, I usually have I usually kind of wrap it up by finding what the other half of the battle is, you know, cause G.I. Joe would always say they would end with knowing is half the battle. But I think today, I think I'm just going to go straight into, you know, Anthony and Rick, you guys have been awesome. And I, you know, what do you want to plug? Like, tell me about your show, Anthony and Rick. Tell me about your website, you know, and all that. And then, you know, we'll kind of just end it where it is because I'm really pleased with how everything turned out. It's been so much fun talking. And I can't think of a better way to kind of end it. So guys, what do you want to plug?
Let Anthony go first because I've been talking too much.
I think it's a good idea to go first anyway because we'll end on the high note with Rick.
There you go.
So I'll plug, as many listeners know by now, I've been on the show multiple times. I'm going to plug my Christmas podcast, Tis the Podcast. The podcast that's determined to keep the Christmas spirit alive 365 days per year. I host it with two co-hosts, Tom and Julia, and we discuss Christmas movies and Christmas television specials and TV episodes all year round. Jerry's basically the fourth co-host now. He's been on so much. He's trying to usurp my role. And yeah, you can find us at tisthepodcast.com/Facebook, Facebook group, Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, wherever. Choose your poison.
And Rick, what about you? I know you have a lot of cool stuff out there.
Well, since I haven't been able to make my convention appearances this year, I did start an Etsy shop. I think is at Etsy.com/shop/miserbros. I think that's the address. And I've been putting things up there. I haven't had a chance to put some more things that I want to get up there because I've been so busy. And for some reason, I've been getting a lot more orders, I guess because people are at home, than I usually do on the internet. And then Wes's wife got miserbros.com back up. So we have all the books there and hats and a few other things, but I'm almost sold out on a lot of this stuff. But I am going to keep the books in stock. And like I said, the Frosty book was the last book that we did. And we didn't have it out before Christmas last year, so I'm expecting a lot more orders on that before this Christmas. And my books don't just have, you probably know this, they don't just have the subject Frosty in them. They have like all the, where are the puppets now? Like if we discover or find photographs of the puppets, we put that in the book. So we found the Mortimer Snerd puppet from the pilot that Rankin Bass shot that's lost right now. We found the puppet in a museum, so I put that in the Frosty book, and a bunch of Tad Motionaga's puppets and various different Rudolph puppets and so forth. So the books are kind of an overall Rankin Bass view, especially Christmas-related stuff, within the confines of Frosty and Santa Claus is Coming to Town and all of that. So I like to make the books fun and also cover my appearances because I get to meet a lot of old celebrities and artists and great people that love Rankin Bass, you know. A lot of those people know Rankin Bass too, you know. I can't think of all of them at once, but you know, you'd be surprised some of the celebrities that you know over the years that were in movies and TV grew up with Rankin Bass too. So you tell them, hey, you know, or here's a book on Rudolph, and they know right away what that is. So it's kind of cool to be the kind of the keeper of all that stuff.
Right on. Well, I got to say thank you guys so much for coming on. It's been a lot of fun, like, talking with you and learning about all this stuff and really just experiencing the wonder that is Rankin Bass and their animagic again. And on that note, I'm going to end it by saying, doesn't Santa take a little bit of that unhappiness away? Doesn't a smile on Christmas morning scratch out a tear cried on a Saturday? Not much, maybe. But what would happen if we all tried to be like Santa and learn to give as only he can give of ourselves, our talents, our love, and our hearts? Maybe we could all learn Santa's beautiful lesson, and maybe there would finally be peace on earth and goodwill toward men. And maybe you can check us out on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're feeling like Rudolph being asked to lead Santa's sleigh on Christmas Eve, leave us a review on iTunes. Not only does it help us reach more people, but you also get a free sticker. Now don't forget to vote. Later, dudes. So, quotes, you know, instead of doing a gag me with the spoon, I think, you know, we kind of did some of our favorite quotes, but now I'd like to do something I like to call to the max. And in this, we're actually going to really do our favorite quotes here. And so normally I let the guests go first, but I'm kind of selfish right now because I love Rankin Bass. And so I'm going to do one first. And this is from Rudolph. And it's where they first notice that his nose is red and it glows. And Donner says, his beak blinks like a blinking beacon.
I'm going to piggyback off that one because I have a Donner quote too. That's when he creates a nose for Rudolph to try on. And Rudolph is like, I don't want to, Daddy. I don't like it. You'll like it and wear it. Oh, but Daddy, it's not very comfortable. There are more important things than comfort. Self-respect. Santa can't object to you now.
Man, he's such a jerk. Oh, man. So there's when Hermie and Rudolph are together, and Hermie says, hey, what do you say we both be independent together, huh? And you wouldn't mind my red nose? Not if you don't mind me being a dentist. It's a deal.
Clearly, Rudolph is terrible. Has no idea what a dentist is. Yeah. I'm going to piggyback. I've got to continue with the bad reindeer, and this is Comet. And it's and when it's when Rudolph is trying to follow him and all the other reindeer, oh no, you don't. You'd better go home with your folks. Now I'm gang. We won't let Rudolph join in any reindeer games, right? Like, what an awful teacher.
That reminds me of Shiny New Year when Father Time is telling Rudolph about everything, and he says, about how they're kind of persecuting the baby Happy, and he says, I bet they wouldn't even let him play New Year's games. It's like, what? What is it? Okay, whatever. Oh, it's so clever. But yeah, there's some good ones. But I kind of want to expand and not just stick with Rudolph. And so on that note, I'm going to go with Frosty, where he says, sorry to drip and run, but this weather is bad for my health. Drip and run. Oh, man. I love that line. I always love that line.
How Frosty has like an existential crisis when he comes to life, and he's like, happy birthday. Hey, I said my first words, but snowmen can't talk. All right, come on now. What's the joke? Could I really be alive?
It's so clever, but it's, you know, yeah, it's definitely funny. Oh man, I got one from Thundercats.
Ooh.
And it's Lion-O, and I'm gonna try my best, but there's no way I can get his voice, but I'm gonna try anyway. Sword of Omens, give me sight beyond sight. I always love that. Oh, I love that line. So good.
I just love how over the top the Burgermeister is. Stop! In the name of the law, you brats are under arrest. Take them away. And Chris is like, don't arrest those children. It was my fault. I gave them the toys. You? How dare you? You are obviously a nonconformist and a rebel. Me? A rebel? Arrest this man immediately. And then he gives him the yo-yo, and he's like, for you. Yo-yo? I love yo-yos. I used to be able to do all kinds of tricks. Wee! And then Grimsley reminds him, sir, you're breaking your own laws. What? What are you saying? Oh, I have been bamboozled! Arrest him! Arrest him!
It's so good. Oh man, it's so good. Let's see. Oh, okay, I got one. Let's do, and I tell you what, I'll let you be Smaug, but let's do from The Hobbit, where Bilbo the burglar has just entered and Smaug wakes up.
I'm gonna preface this by saying the voice of Smaug in The Hobbit, he just sounds like he's talking in a deep voice.
Pretty much.
He doesn't have the growl like he has in the live action movies, but well, thief, I smell you. I feel your air, and I hear your breath. Come along. Help yourself. There's plenty and to spare.
Oh, thank you, Smaug the Magnificent. I did not come for wealth. I wish only to have a look at you and see if you are truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them.
Do you now?
They fall utterly short of reality, King Smaug under the mountain.
You have nice manners. For a thief and a liar.
That's so good. That was good, man. You're doing awesome with these impressions here. Oh man, let's see. Okay, here's one from Heat Miser. Some like it hot, but I like it really hot.
Oh man, what's a snow? Hold on, I need to look it up.
I should have let you do that because you're the you're the angry Anthony.
Hey, I don't know how I got stuck with Heat Miser or somehow. I always thought it was Snowfire. Snow Miser. So I like when Snow Miser's talking to Mrs. Claus. So, Mrs. C, how's your hubby? And Mrs. Claus is like, not too good, Snowy. He's got a bad cold. Oh, that's a shame. He should have come to see me. I didn't give him a good one. Oh, a little chilly humor there.
It's so good. Oh, man. Oh, let's see. There's so many. Oh, man. I don't even think I can.
To piggyback off that one, when Heat Miser talks to Mrs. Claus, he's like, "Well, well, Mrs. Claus, how's your husband doing? Out doing another commercial for my brother? Oh, come now. You know he's not on your brother's payroll."
On your brother's payroll. Oh, man.
Oh, I love the song in "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." They're come on, so old Kris good. Kringle, down the Milky Way.
Mm. And we need you today.
Today.
Oh, so good, yeah. Let's see.
That one is so underrated. That's actually our last episode this year.
Is it?
Proper episode before Christmas, yeah.
That's a good one, yeah.
I mean, we'll see if Tom and Julie like it. I'm hoping they give it a little more grace since it is a traditionally animated one and they seem to like Frosty. So we'll see.
I hope so. Yeah, the only thing I don't like about it is Santa. Beard. Yeah, it's that without the musty, like Amish beard thing going on. That's the only thing I really don't like about it. But
I think A Christmas Story Santa looks better than that one.
Oh, man, that's rough. Oh, okay, well, here's between Albert and Father Mouse. That's it, Father. I'll fix the clock by midnight. Then maybe Santa will... You believe in Santa? I don't know, but I've learned that I've still got a lot to learn. But son, you don't know how to fix a clock. That's all right, Father. Copernicus knew.
You sound just like him.
I tried my best. I really tried.
So I'm going to stick with the Earth out of Santa Claus.
Okay.
And Mrs. Santa's asking Pete Miser, would you mind doing us a favor? I don't see why I should. No one does it ever does anything for me. What is it? Could you let it snow in the south for one day? What? Snow in the south? Just for one day? Never!
Oh, man.
I'm not even going to attempt to do anything from Godzooks. Tom owned Godzooks.
He did. Godzooks was good. Yeah, he had a good Godzooks. Let's see. Okay, so it's Colonel Wellington B. Bunny and his assistant. And Colonel Bunny says, wait, Peter Cottontail, just a moment. Now here's a likely candidate. Well, I really don't think Cottontail's your man, sir. I mean, he is boastful. He has no sense of responsibility. And sometimes he fibs. Oh, well, I know he's not perfect, but he's got real spunk and ingenuity. Reminds me of me when I was his age.
So I'm going to go to Rudolph and Frosty's Christmas in July.
Ooh,
and this is after Rudolph breaks the scepter and we find out all of a sudden, well, Winterbolt gives it away in the quote, "No! Oh, yeah. When my scepter dies, I turn into a tree." And he turns into a tree and Lily Lorraine is, "Oh, what an exit."
Oh, man, that's so good.
As I always say, a family that slides together abides together. Frosty, you never say that. Stick to the script, Dad. Well, Santa doesn't get here soon. We're going to be sticking to everything.
I remember that one. Oh, man. Wow. We covered that more than a year ago.
We did.
Like a year and a half ago. Oh, wow. That's crazy. Oh, Frosty's goodness.
Frosty's hat has its own kind of magic.
Oh, yeah, and you were like crazy awesome at the Snow Genie, the genie snow of the genie. Ice Scepter. Yeah.
That one is so tricky.
It is. It is.
And you have the druggy reindeer scratchers. So
Lily Lorraine. Oh, man. Okay, so I know I wasn't going to, but I think we got it. I think I can't break tradition after all. If G.I. Joe says that knowing is half the battle, what would you say is the other half?
No, what would I say is the other half? you know, having a Rankin Bass historian in your pocket to talk to you about what's going through their minds that they're making these specials. But
there you go.
But also, if any studio is listening out there and you want to remake these specials well and with heart, give Jerry and myself a call, because we clearly have a passion for it.
For real. Yeah. We'll all join on. It'll be fun. So for me, and that's better than mine, for me is if knowing is half the battle, the other half of the battle is animagic.
It's true.
That's all. Clearly, I put a lot of thought into that one.